Pretty much the story goes that there's a certain group of women had of men who had gender reassignment surgeries to become women, and then they became from after they were born, and they hoodwinked.
And after the change.
Yes, after the operation, and yeah. They hoodwinked men in from men into marrying them. So a number of questions came out of this. First of all, has the world ever heard of such a case happening? Second of all, if such a thing was possible with this, the checks that based in put in place. Third being, what are the ramifications of this? And fourth being, in the case of the normal issue of homosexuality, these people would not be engaging in normal homosexual activities if these people are in fact men. So are they, albeit the shoegaze, homosexuality?
Yeah, this is that's an amazing case. Obviously, I've heard of sex change operations. I have not heard of that particular twist, but, you know, it's theoretically entirely possible. I have no idea if it's true. Let me just tell you what the poskim generally say. The poskim generally say halacha does not recognize a sex change surgery. Therefore, when a man changes to a woman, they are still halachically a man. If they are still halachically a man, then a man that marries them does not have any kedushin. They don't need a get. Unfortunately, it would halachically seem to be mishkav zachar, homosexual relations, the shoget. Now, I do want to differentiate sex change, or it's called gender reassignment surgeries, the fancier euphemistic term, with cases of tumtum or androgynous. Now, there's another problem where people are born with either indeterminate gender or they're born with both sons. Halacha does permit a certain gender assignment. In other words, you're not obligated to leave somebody in the condition of a tumtum or an androgynous. And that's the more common problem. Nevertheless, to totally change a person who is definitively a man into a woman, or vice versa, halacha would simply not recognize it. Now, again, this is very, very painful because people that struggle with these issues, you know, are suffering. But this would not be a solution. We would have to explore therapy, psychological treatment, various other ways of helping them and the like. Similar, indeed, to any. I mean, let's say a man doesn't want to change into a woman, but he has a desire for homosexuality. You know, once again, you can't monitor the activity, but you try to deal with it on a psychological level. So that would be the case. Now, I was going to say at first, but I see it's not necessary. I was going to say that the marriage wouldn't be valid because it's a kedushin b'tayis. But the truth is, you don't need kedushin b'tayis because a man marrying a man doesn't need anything. But where you do have kedushin b'tayis is this. This is actually a tshuva of Rav Moshe, where a woman marries a man, and she then discovers he's gay. So Rav Moshe Paskin, she does not need a get, because that is such a fundamental assumption in a marriage that there will be heterosexual attraction, that is actually mafkia, the kedushin, the mafreya, and you don't need a get. Now that's different, because there it is a man who married a woman, so I need the swara of kedushin betais, a kedushin under a mistake, in order to invalidate. But that's an awful, horrendous story. Yeah.
If a man, or anybody,
put
an affair to someone a long time ago, does he still have the true first affair? At least 30 years. I don't know if it's different of an affair or a makom, but would there be obligation to tshuva today?
Well,
there's
always an obligation to do tshuva if you haven't done tshuva, but the only question is there an obligation to ask mechila as part of that tshuva? See, those are two different questions. Tshuva is I go to the Ribbono Shel Olam and I'm misvada and I'm makabel, I have charata and I'm makabel on the future. Now, whether or not you have to ask a mechila of a person, this would depend. This would depend on whether, if you think that it's likely that the person was already mochel you, you're not mechuyiv to seek them out. If you think that the person has not been mochel you, then you're obligated to try to have a bakashas mechila. So it would depend on how you evaluate the situation. I also want to remind people of a very famous machlokas between Rabbi Saul Salanter and the Chafetz Chaim. This is one of the great, great machlokas in this whole inyan. Rabbi Saul Salanter was older than the Chafetz Chaim, and towards the end of Rabbi Saul Salanter's life, the Chafetz Chaim Sefer on the laws of Lashon Hara came out. And Rabbi Saul Salanter liked the Sefer a lot, and he said, oh, Kadosh Baruch Hu is preparing the Gadol for the next generation. The Chafetz Chaim was only in his 30s. He was not well known even. But it is recorded that there was one halacha in the Sefer Chafetz Chaim that Rabbi Saul Salanter was cholek with. And that is, the Chafetz Chaim says, if I spoke Lashon Hara about you, I said something bad about you, whether it's true or false, then it's Motzi Shemra. So that is a sin, Bein Adam LaChavero. I said something that causes you to be looked at askance. So I am mechuyev to ask your forgiveness, and you have the right to say, what did you do? So that would mean, I, according to the Chafetz Chaim, I go over to you, Erev Yom Kippur, or really any day, and I say, I really want to ask your mechila because I spoke Lashon Hara about you. And you can say, what did you say about me? And then I'll say, well, you don't want to know. He says, no, I do want to know. So, unfortunately, according to the Chafetz Chaim, I would have to reveal it to you, or you don't have to be mochel me. So it is said that Rabbi Saul Salanter disagreed with that halacha. Why? Because he said that the old idea that don't be a tzaddik on somebody else's cheshbon. You want your mechila, so you're going to tell something to somebody that's going to embarrass him, that's going to hurt him. You're going to cause him to feel worse. So in such a situation, you're called an onus on the chiyuv of asking for mechila, and you just pray to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he should put into the heart of that person to not have a grudge or whatever it is. So based on that idea, going back to your question, you have to be Mashiach as well. Now, how do we pass him? So it says, B'Shem Rav Aaron Cutler, it is said that Rabbi Saul Salanter is considered to be the final posek in all matters, Bein Adam L'Chaveru, even more than the Chafetz Chaim. So based on that, I would just add to your question that if you are Mashiach, that by asking for forgiveness, you're going to stir up negative feelings of hatred, embarrassment, and the like, then I think you should be samech and Rabbi Saul Salanter to pray to Hashem that they should forgive you, but not actively seek mechila, because you shouldn't seek mechila if that's going to cause the person that you're asking tsar and agitation. That's an important aspect. Yeah.
When a psak is given based on pre-bracha or other such factors, and the actual mitzias might be contrary to the psak or psak, is there any kind of consequence actually called that? I mean, it's in regards to kashrus, if you're someone on chazaka and tumtum olev, and actually the food is trait, but chazaka says not, or in case of say mamzerim or the like, or other such cases.
Yeah, this is a big machlokas. I mean, an example would be, it really depends. Let's take the concept of tumtum olev. Tumtum olev says that when a person eats non-kosher food, it affects their spiritual development. It creates a certain blockage in their ability to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the question is the following. That's obviously the case if I'm eating something I'm not allowed to eat, right? I'm not allowed to eat. But what about cases where I'm allowed to eat what I ate, but it turns out to be treif? One example, which is not your question, is a person eats a treif because he's a chola sheyesh la sakana. He's allowed to eat it. He's mechuyev to eat it. He eats on Yom Kippur because pikuach nefesh. Is there a timtum alev? Another example is batal b'shishah. If you have something treif, but it's in a mixture, and according to halacha it gets nullified in 60, but you're still eating it, is there tzimtzum aleif? A third example is, if you rely on hashgacha, that's a reliable hashgacha, or there are principles like chazaka that say you're allowed to make certain assumptions, does that take away the spiritual damage of tzimtzum aleif? So in many ways, philosophically, it depends how you understand tzimtzum aleif. Is tzimtzum aleif a mitzias, or does it arise from the status of Israel? Let me give you an example. Let's take poison. Poison physically has a characteristic that will kill you. So even if you relied on the best supervision of the world, you still took poison. Now the question is, if you look at Timtum Halev as an intrinsic characteristic of that which Hashem answered, then it would appear that there could be Timtum Halev even if the halacha permits you to eat it, because that's the mitzias of what it is. However, most Rishayim say of different form. Most Rishayim say that the Timtum Halev comes because you violated Hashem's commandments by eating something you weren't supposed to eat. So under any circumstance where the halacha permitted you to do what you're doing, whether it's sakana, bitul b'shishem, chazaka, or the like, there will be no negative consequence because you followed the halacha. Now the only question you might ask me is, well, wait a second here. We know that a person brings a korban if they transgress b'shogeg, meaning if they thought something was kosher and it turned out to be treif. But if the idea is it's only a sin if you intend to rebel against Hashem, why should it be a sin? So this is tricky, because we do understand that a person could sin not only by intentionally violating a Kadosh Baruch Hu's ratzon, but by failure to check it out. So in many cases of shogeg, there was negligence. You had two pieces of meat, you didn't check which one was which. By contrast, when you follow a hashgacha, when you follow an authority, when you follow a psak, that is different than a stam shogeg. A stam shogeg is, I was careless. A psak is when you're tole your behavior, you hang your behavior on the decision of somebody that is supposed to be greater than you. So I would differentiate between stam, a mix-up of a shogeg, versus a psak. There is a raya to this. The raya to this is, although at the same time it's a raya, there's also a refutation in the raya. That is, that it says that if a yochid violated the Torah by following the psak of a beistin, the yachid is putter from a carbon chattas, and only the beistin brings what's called the par helem dabor. Meaning to say, the yachid that follows a psak beistin is putter from a chattas. The only problem is that, according to the halacha, that really only applies to the decision of the Sanhedrin of 71, meaning they can change the reality. It may not apply to the decision of an individual rav or a posek. So it's a bit of a question, meaning there are concepts which say if the halacha matters it, that changes even the timtum alev and it changes the definition of an avera. There are others that say this is a special koach of the Sanhedrin of 71 and it would not necessarily be transferable. Now you may remember a few years ago that, again, we have awful stories tonight, there was another awful story in Muncie about a butcher who was from, and he gave daf yomi shiurim, he was a person who seemed to be a righteous person, and unfortunately it was discovered that for several years he was actually selling treif. I don't mean, you know, not mahadra nashkach, I'm talking about treif mamish, and his customers were, you know, chassidim, kolol people, and they were eating treif for several years. It's very, very interesting. He never brought his meat home to his house. It's very, very neat. And then he told his family, you know, he gave some reasons why we don't eat this meat or whatever it is, but he was Michael Trafus. And this was a great tragedy, and people discussed whether there would be Timtum Halev under these situations. And, you know, there were debates back and forth. There was not a clear achlata. It really depends on whether chazaka or rov are simply rules of probability. You could be Taila, but It's like Russian roulette, right? In other words, you're okay, but if the bullet hits you, you know, you're in trouble. Or do I say the psak halacha is mishana, the very metzias? Right, so there are rayas mikana mikana, and it's difficult. It's actually a very difficult question.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah. It could also apply to in a case of Zeres, like it's almost. I mean, there are chazakas and whatnot that rely upon the same kind of concept applied there.
Yes, it would. But mamzer is actually an easier case than kashrus, because the Torah itself says that if someone is a safek mamzer, min ha-Torah there is no isra, meaning even if he is a mamzer, if it's a masav of safek, to oraisa there's no isra. We don't have such a rule by kashrus. By kashrus, the rule seems to be if it is treif, it is treif. Right? Mamzer, safek mamzer is mutter min ha-Torah. So by mamzer, you would not have the pagam. You would actually would not in that case. Yes, well, because the Torah didn't, in other words, the Torah didn't aser the matzav of Suffolk. Did you want to say?
Yeah, I want to ask. When you're speaking about the controversy about whiskey. Because there's some, there are many problems about whiskey, and now that many people who are really caring about the soul, they're not drinking whiskey.
Well, it's good not to drink that much anyway. I know at the 3:45 mincha, someone had a yard site, so he had some bottles of vodka. I was running that. They're not the best thing to take for the afternoon. But here's the thing: not all whiskey is a problem. I mean, the big problem. Which is a big issue in the States, I guess maybe here too, is what is called single malt scotch. Single malt scotch, again, I am absolutely not a bucky in any of this, but that's considered to be, as opposed to blended scotch, single malt scotch is a metzia. If you're a person who's into whiskey, this is what you want to drink, right? You know, at the Mentor's Mission, we'll have single malt scotch and all of these different inyanim. Now, the problem is the following. The problem is that single malt scotch is made in a certain way. These are recipes that go back hundreds and hundreds of years in Scotland, all sorts of exact ways of doing it. And one of the things they do is they age them, 15 years, 20 years, sometimes 30 years or 100 years, The older it is, the more money you pay. But they age them in oak barrels, which had been used for the storage of sherry. Now, sherry is a wine. So these barrels had been suffused with wine, and there's supposed to be a little bit of that sherry taste that goes into the single malt scotch. Now, scotch itself is made from barley, and it is not considered to be treif per se, but the problem is it has absorbed from the sherry casks the taste of wine, and if that's so, the wine is not mavushel, certainly, and it would aser because it imparts a taste. Now, the problem is that the amount of water and barley in the cask is many times more than 60 times the taste of the wine. And therefore, even if the wine is treif, the wine, the argument would be, those who matir say that the wine is batel b'shishim, and based on the idea of batel b'shishim, you're allowed to drink. Other people say that doesn't make sense. The whole svara of batel b'shishim is that normally you don't taste it. That if there's 60 times the meat against the milk, you don't taste the milk. If there's 60 times the milk against the meat drop, you don't taste the meat. But here, the whole purpose of putting it in the cask is that there should be some taste. And although most of us might not taste it, but those who are b'kiyim, they're going to taste a little bit of the sherry. So because of this, many poskim say that single malt scotch that has been kept in sherry barrels, which is really all single malt scotch, should not be drunk. Others do say to be samech on batel b'shishim. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva in which he actually says that it is batel and it is permitted, but he says a bal nefesh, a person who is more conscientious, should refrain from drinking it. So that would be it. And that is the problem. The problem with all whiskeys is only if there's a mixture of wine. Many blends don't have that. Not all whiskeys have that problem, but you have to be aware that some of them do, and it'll be a problem of stam yenam, and then you have a big machlokas, whether there is bitol b'shishim for something that is added to impart a taste. This is called milsa diavito l'taima, is not going to be butel. So they tell him, I remember reading this, I don't know if it's true, that Rav Moshe was at a kiddush or something, and someone had the single malt scotch, and Rav Moshe took the chavod, the simcha, he took a tiny little taste, little mudnik, because Rav Moshe holds it's mutter, a bal nefesh should be machmir, but he held that for kavod abrios, if it would embarrass the host, for that he was mevatzer on a bat. In other words, you wouldn't be allowed to do treif. If something was usher, you wouldn't be allowed to eat it. But I can't eat something treif not to embarrass somebody. But in this case, Rav Moshe was willing to take a little sip of it for that reason. Okay? Now, again, I'm not a tremendous bucky. I believe every single malt scotch is aged in a sherry cask, but there might be minim that are not. So if they're not, they would be okay. Okay? Yeah.
What is the isur of Kodisha and what are the chumras in Kodis?
Yeah. Yeah, Kolisha has two different halachas, by the way. It's very important to know that there are two different halachas about Kolisha. Halacha number one is that when a woman is singing, you are not allowed to say a bracha or say kriyashma or davin shmona esrei or even say words of Torah. You can think words of Torah, but not, in other words, it's the same set of halachas if a woman is not dressed properly. It's also true for kolisha. Now that rule is a very strict rule. That rule is very, very strict. That even applies to your own wife. And that even applies to when she's not a nida. In other words, this rule has nothing to do with nida or not nida. Nothing to do with your wife or not your wife. If your wife is singing, you are not allowed to do these things. Now, let's focus on that halacha for a moment, because that halacha is the most absolute. That halacha applies even to your wife. However, interestingly enough, it may not apply to girls below the age in which they menstruate, meaning below the age of 11 or so. Okay. Now, the question that this raises is the following. Can I sing Zemiros with my wife? Zemiros seems to be Divrei Torah, Divrei Tefillah. And even if it's just me and my wife, in other words, nobody else, just my wife, right? Is it going to be us? So Rav Shlomo Zalman matters it, because Rav Shlomo Zalman actually took the position that Zemiros are not Divrei Torah, and they're also not brachos or tefilos. They are generic praises of God. And that's not nichlal in this din of kolisha. So, Baruch Hashem, if you're with your wife, you can sing Zemiros together. But Rav Yashiv was machmer. And Rav Yashiv basically said, let your wife sing alone, and you learn without moving your lips, because that way, you can't say the Zemiros because you would be davening while she's singing. But you can learn with Hirur, because the Isser of Kolisha here is only to say and not to be Mahara. Alright, so in this, obviously it's not my kayach to be Machriya, but I will tell you that I personally do follow the Pesach of Rav Shlomo Zalman for that. Now, a more difficult Shaila, though, in which Rav Shlomo Zalman's teretz is not a good teretz, is can I bench with my wife if we sing benching? You know, people sing benching. Now there, you can't give Rav Shlomo Zalman's teretz that, well, Zemiros are not officially Divrei Torah, and it's not officially Tefillah. Birkas HaMazon is a Chiyuv D'Oraisa. It's certainly a Bracha. So, how can I bench if my wife is singing the benching? So there, indeed, that's very, very difficult to matur. If we do matur it, we matur it based on the idea of trei koli. If two people are singing, you don't make out the voices distinctively, although that's difficult with husband and wife, and that could be the basis of a heter. but it would be better indeed. It would be better indeed for husband and wife not to be singing the benching together for that reason, because Rav Shlomo Zalman's heter does not directly apply. Now, one other thing. The Chazon Ish mentions this, and this is from the Rishonim. So I'm telling you a halacha now that if women are singing, I'm not allowed to speak words of Torah or say brachos. Well, that's fine. If I'm with my wife, I tell her don't sing now. But what if I'm just hearing things? There are schools across the street, whatever it is. Does that mean I can't daven, I can't learn if I hear voices of singing? All right, so maybe you'll be simech on multiple voices. But let's say I hear one woman. Let's say I hear a woman across the street kind of singing. Am I allowed? So here the Chazon Ish says there's kind of a heter, and it's based on Eis Lasos Lashem, that when there's no other way, we're permitted to Chazal Rekoveya, that sometimes we don't have to follow a halacha. Again, it's very rare, and only Chazal could do it. But the Chazon Ish brings from the Rishonim that if you're simply being bombarded with Kol Isha from outside of your home, and you have no control over what's coming in, because of Eis Lasos Lashem, he does permit you to daven and to learn. So you don't really have to worry about the Kol Isha that comes from a seminary or somebody else's house or the like. Now, let me just finish. Now, this is what we'll call Kol Isha number one. Kol Isha number one is the Isser of davening, learning, and Devorim Shepe Kedusha if a woman is singing. Now, Kol Isha number two is, I'm not learning, I'm not davening, I just want to go to the opera. I want to hear a woman sing. There are Rishonim, by the way, some, you know, Paschim like that, that actually say there's no such rule as Kol Isha number two. There's only Kol Isha number one. And if you want to go to the opera, according to them, putting aside the tznius of the Levush, you can go to the opera. Meaning, there are some Rishonim that actually say Kol Isha is lagamri a din, only in Devarim Shebe Kedusha. This, however, is not the Shulchan Aruch or the Ramah's Psak. Shulchan Aruch and Ramah's Psak is, there's a separate issue of Kol Isha, and it's very, very fascinating, therefore. There is a siman about Kol Isha in Orach Chaim, in Hilchos Kriyat Shema, which is Kol Isha number one. And there's a separate siman of Kol Isha in Evin Ezer that deals with the general laws of Tzmias. It actually appears two different places. Now, Kol Isha number two is a bit more lenient, because although I'm not allowed to listen to women singing, but I am allowed to listen to my wife sing. Machlokes, is that even when she's a nida, or only when she's not a nida? When she's not a nida, for sure I can. When she is a nida, many people are mekel, some people are machmer. Okay, that's a machlokes, but certainly ishto tar is mutter. Many will permit you to listen to your daughter. Right, so you could listen to your daughter sing. Some will permit you to listen to your sister. Right, these are machlokim. But I want to point out, this is only nogeya, the second aspect of Kol Isha. It's not nogeya, the first aspect. Now, in terms of this aspect number two, there are different kulas that some poskim hold of and some poskim don't hold of. One is the trei koli, multiple voices. Some are mekel, although the poskim in Eretz Yisrael tend to be machmir. Many modern Orthodox rabbis in America are very, very mekel on this. Another is the issue of recorded music. Rav Avadzi Yosef was mekel by recordings, but only if you don't know what the woman looks like and or you're not seeing it on a video. Meaning, if you simply have an audio recording and you're not makir, you don't know what the woman looks like. So Rav Avadzia gave a heter. Other poskim do not accept that. So those are the basic ones. Trei koli lo mishtami, and the other is a recording, recorded music versus live performance, and the chiluk of whether you recognize the woman or you don't. Okay, but it is important to know that the Kol Isha for Divrei Torah is a stricter halacha, because that even applies to Ishto Tahor. Did you want to say? Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I have a question, because I read
the
Rashi. When Israel went to Pharaoh, then they saw a giant. The Rashi explained that there were sons of fallen angels in the valley.
Yeah.
And all the, how can angels fall down because they don't have free will? So how can they?
Well, here is the thing. You know, Rashi. See, it depends how you translate it. Rashi is simply quoting Psukim at the end of Parshas Bereishis that talks about the fact that Bnei Elohim, depends how you read it, sons of God, had a desire for the daughters of the earth, and they came. This is in the Chumash. This is not just Rashi. I'll explain. I'm just telling you what the pasuk says. And these are called the Nephilim. So, the truth of the matter is, if you look at Rashi in Parshas Bereishis, you see that Rashi gives a very non-midrashic interpretation there. Rashi says, B'nei Elohim, which according to Rashi should probably be B'nei Elohim, does not mean angels. It just means powerful, wealthy, influential people. The word Elohim is sometimes used in the Chumash not as a reference to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but as a reference to powers. And when it says they saw Benos Aris, it simply means they were abusing their power and taking women as their wives or their mistresses against their will. And they are called Nephilim simply because they fell from the level they should have been. So according to Rashi at least, this is not a fallen angel. These are people who abuse their power. Now the only question is, how do you get giants out of that? That's a good question. If that's all that happened, why are you assuming? But it could very well be that maybe these people were so powerful and respected because they were naturally very, very big. Right? So we don't know. But the point I want to make is that according to Rashi, Nephilim does not mean fallen angels. It just means people who fell from the Madrega they should have been on. Now, Lahavdil, in the Christian tradition, the Christian interpretation of Genesis, they do talk about Satan as being a fallen angel that got kicked out. Now, in Chazal, is there an alternative Shita to Rashi that learns the other way that you were saying? There are some midrashim. They're not mainstream. It's interesting. You know, we have what you call official midrashim, and we have midrashim whose status as the words of Chazal is much more questionable. Meaning we don't know. We're not sure if it's from Chazal or it was influenced by Christianity. We're not sure. Now I'll give you an example. The official midrashim that we know are from Chazal and are part of Torah Shebal Peh, the Medrash Rabbah, the Medrash Tanchuma, the Pesikta, Pirkei de Rebbe Eliezer, the Yalkut Shemini, which is actually not a Medrash, but it's an anthology of Midrashim. This is part of our Masorah, the Yalkut. These are the words of Chazal. But we have different fragments that were found over the past 1,000 years that do not appear either in the Gemara or the Midrashim that were Mekubal. And we're not so sure what they represent. We're not so sure. And in those fragments you will find references to fallen angels, but we're not sure if that's part of our Masorah. But if you're asking me, let's play devil's advocate, which is another reference to Christian angelology. Yeah, and that, what is the source that you saw for that?
I saw about how Bilam, the prophet, acquired his first prophecy because he went to two fallen angels and he did a whole ceremony how he acquired his fourth.
Okay, so what I'm telling you is what you have is you do have later Sfarim, Kaveh Yetzer is a later Sefer, that sometimes utilize these Midrashim, but we're not entirely clear if it's a Chelek of the Masorah. But let's assume that it is, and let's see if there's any explanation. The question becomes, really you're asking, can an angel rebel against Hashem, right? We normally say that the difference between a human being and a malach is that a malach is not a baal bechira. Malach can only do his job, and a human being is a baal bechira. So if that's so, it would be, your argument is, logically impossible for an angel to kind of fall out of Shemayim because of some sinful desire or sinful act that the angel, it is a very good question, but I think the idea would be that Hashem may have created certain angels with a limited power to exercise bechira, and maybe only one area, not total, but in one area, in order to kind of put into the world the kayach bechira. In other words, angels are the media by which Hashem brings certain powers into the world. Now, human bechira is one of those powers. So in a sense, you may have to have an angel with the capacity of bechira that brings the kayach of bechira in the world. So that's one way of understanding it, that Hashem programmed certain angels with a limited capacity of choice as instrumentalities for bringing in choice. But again, I want to emphasize that Rashi's Havana of Nephilim has mamish nothing to do with that whole cheshbon. So go look at the Rashi in Brachos and you say, yeah.
I'm talking about giants. The Rav mentioned last week about Aaron Cohen being very tall. We know that Moshe Rabbeinu was also very tall, and he couldn't even reach up to the knees of even a
Yeah.
How seriously should we take that, or how literally should we take those things?
Yeah, I'm glad you switched your word from seriously to literally. Everything, everything Chazal say has to be taken absolutely seriously. And everything Chazal say is absolutely true. But the Maral was Mechadesh, right? The classical dichotomy that people have about Midrashim is they say, oh, is the Midrash true or is the Midrash false? The Maral said there's a third way of looking at the question. All Midrashim are true, but truth is sometimes a symbolic truth and not always a literal truth. Chazal expressed deep spiritual ideas which are 100% true in the use of mishalim, parables, analogies, metaphors, hyperbole. And the goal of trying to understand is what is the ultimate message that Chazal are trying to tell us. Now the truth is, the Rambam himself wrote this a long time before. And in fact, the Rambam says some midrashim are meant to be literal, and some midrashim, not just midrashim, chazals, are meant to be metaphors and mishalim. And the Rambam promised us he was going to write a sefer that will tell you which midrashim are literal and which midrashim are metaphors. And unfortunately, as far as we know, this is one of the great lost or undone svarim that the Rambam wasn't able to get to. So we don't have the Rambam. But the great Mefarish that tries to expose the symbolic truth of Agadita is the Maral. The Maral, of course, lived much later than the Rambam. Maral lived in the 1500s. But all of the Maral's many svarim, not every single sefer, is devoted to trying to expose the symbolism of the Agadita. And in fact, the Maral talks about these Agadatas very specifically. That Moshe Rabbeinu was a certain height and Og was a certain height. A height is simply a physical way of speaking about certain spiritual powers. And although, well, what does that mean? So you're telling me Og had more spiritual power than Moshe Rabbeinu? That doesn't make sense, certainly. Moshe Rabbeinu was obviously a much bigger tzaddik. But the Maral goes through, it's very abstract, but he goes through a different idea, is that Og had certain kochos in a certain area that made it difficult for Moshe to defeat him. And that's the lashon of Chazal. Rav Yisrael Salanter once gave a mashal to that type of speaking. What is symbolic language? And he gave a very simple mashal from journalism, of all things. You know, in the 19th century, when Rav Yisrael Salanter lived, so Jews in Russia were not allowed to live everywhere. They could only live in certain areas. And this was called the Pale of Settlement. They couldn't live in big cities, you know, they had to be dispersed. And the Tsars kept on changing the Pale of Settlement. So commonly they would simply say to a whole Jewish population, you have 2 weeks to be out of here, you got to move to this district. You know, every 3 years or so, there was these mass movements. So let's imagine you were a reporter for a newspaper in Russia, and you might write something about this. You know, you're seeing hundreds of thousands of people moving, you know, having to move overnight. So you might write in this lashon, with a drop of ink from the Tsar's pen, drowned 200,000 people. Meaning the Tsar's signature on the paper, ordering expulsion, destroyed the lives of 200,000 people. But the reporter said, the drop of ink from the pen drowned 200,000 people. Now let's imagine you found that newspaper 200 years later. And you read a newspaper that says, a drop of ink of the Tsar's pen drowned 200,000 people. You're going to say, what type of Bubba Mice is that? What do you mean? How can a drop of ink drown 200,000 people? Are you talking about the people are midgets or the Tsar is a super giant? And you're going to say, ridiculous, superstitious, makes no sense. But if you understood the Mice, you see what a vivid way it is to convey the truth of how a single signature changed people's lives. The Vesos Lanter said, that is the Lashon of Agadata. That is how Chazal spoke. And again, on the most superficial level, that is a very exciting way to grab your attention. And Chazal had a mission to get people attentive. In fact, Chazal used Agadata to keep people awake when they were falling asleep. On a more deeper level, Chazal wanted to convey spiritual truths in this type of Lashon. It is not at all the case that all Midrashim have to be taken literally. And if you look at the Maral says that the bulk of them are symbolic expressions of deeper spiritual truths. Does that mean they're false? No, not at all. They are conveying truths in a certain medium. They are absolutely true. But this is the Lashon that they are using. Yeah.
Regarding different accents in Russian or Polish, I wanted to ask, and this is not attack to you or any of the fellow Americans
yeah.
I wanted to know about the pronunciation of the O, for example, Torah. Is that just an accent thing, or is that actually a mistake?
No, we have a lot of, you know, the Cholam in particular has many, many pronunciations. There is Torah, which you call the American pronunciation. There is Torah, which is the Yeki pronunciation. There is Teira, which is the Litvisha pronunciation. There is Toira, which is the Polish and Russian pronunciation. And there are many other variations as well, different Sephardic pronunciations and the like. And of course, the Kamatz and the Patach, right? Ashkenazim, all Ashkenazim differentiate between A and A. And most Sfardim do not differentiate, right? The O and the A are pronounced, the Kamatz and the Patach are pronounced the same way. And these are very difficult questions, and that is somebody right and somebody wrong? I mean, L'chaireh, Hebrew started off as a single language. When the Jews left Mitzrayim, one of their merits was they spoke Lashon HaKodesh. Yeah? So they must have spoken it a certain way. And if they spoke in a certain way, how do we get all of these different variations over the years? And what was the way Moshe Rabbeinu spoke? What was the way Avraham Avinu spoke? To go all the way back. So some suggest, a lot of people say, well, probably the closest pronunciation to the Avos is the Yemenite. The Yemenite, Temani pronunciation. Which is very interesting. Temani actually has a W sound. They pronounce Rov, it's kind of Rov. They kind of put in a W. And, you know, it may be so, but I'll tell you that Temani itself is very influenced by Arabic. So, you know, so it's not so much of the Temani. It's the old. So what has happened basically is, and I'm not a tremendous bucky in this, but I will tell you what happened basically was that Hebrew pronunciation got linked with the pronunciation patterns of the host languages of the diaspora. So German Jews pronounced Lashon HaKodesh the way German was spoken. And French and England and Polish and Russian and Ukrainian and all the variations. And I should mention too, that's Hasidim. They pronounce the U, the Shuruk, as if it's an E. They'll say Elikeini. Because in Slavic languages, there is such a pronunciation. So the question becomes, if my Hebrew is because of English or German or French or Russian, am I Yotze Lashon HaKodesh? It's a very, very good question. Most poskim say that the definition of a spoken language is how a community speaks it. Meaning you're not mechuyev to go back to ancestral Hebrew, but the meaning of a miftah, the legitimacy of a pronunciation, is based on whatever the minog is. So if I idiosyncratically just mispronounce Hebrew, that doesn't count. But if the whole community mispronounces it a certain way, that becomes a legitimate way of speaking. This is what most poskim say. So they say Ashkenazim don't have to change to Sephardim, and Sephardim don't have to change to Ashkenazim. The only thing is, based on that, there is some discussion whether a Sephardi could be Motzi in Ashkenazi in Kriyas HaTorah, and vice versa, based on that. Meaning, within my Kehila, this is the appropriate language, but not for someone from a member of another Kehila. That's something to be careful about. And I will tell you that in particularly in either modern Orthodox congregations in the United States or Dati Leumi congregations in Eretz Israel, you really have that problem where they daven Nusach Ashkenaz, but the Havara for Tefillah, I'm also speaking modern Hebrew, the Havara for Tefillah is the like spoken Hebrew, which is really Sephardic. And there is a question, are you Yotze? Hey, Lemaisa, we're Mekel, but it is a serious question, and especially for Parshas Zohar, that's a mitzvah d'oraisa, for Hashem, here in Or Sameach, we follow this. The Bal Korei, right? We'll have a Bal Korei for Ashkenaz and a Bal Korei for Sfarad and a Bal Korei for Taimani. Of course, you might include some more as well, but that would keep you there the whole day. Now, I did see a sefer, a very interesting sefer, written by a Moroccan Rav who basically is encouraging Klal Yisrael to try to go back to the original pronunciation of Hebrew, and he claims it's basically Taimani, more or less. And he says he knows that it's impossible for adults, because once we've learned the language, you know, it's very hard for us. We can't pronounce it that way. But he urged that all children should be taught the Taimani Miftah. It makes sense. On the other hand, the poskim have not gone there. The poskim have said each kehila holds on to its minhag. Okay, so based on that, probably no pronunciation today is the way Moshe Rabbeinu spoke. On the other hand, all of those pronunciations are considered to be legitimate because they become the minhag of a kehila, and that becomes valid. Yeah.
As the Rebbe mentioned, once upon a time, Hebrew was a spoken language amongst the Jewish people. Is the opposition to spoken Hebrew today amongst the Torah, some part of the Torah community, is that
some part,
because
yeah,
it's from Ben Yehuda and it's, you know, the secular tainted, or because they actually have an intrinsic problem with speaking, speaking Hebrew as a spoken language?
Some people have said that they are against the concept of Hebrew as a spoken language because it should only be used for Kedusha. That frankly is a very strange position. It's a very strange position because in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, in the time of the Tanakh, Hebrew was the spoken language. It's very hard to say that HaKadosh Baruch Hu only wanted it for Kedusha because it was used. Now, the second argument though is a real argument, and that is that the claim is that modern Hebrew is not really Lashon HaKodesh. It is a new creation called Ivrit, which incorporates Lashon HaKodesh, but it incorporates many other things as well. And the inventor really was invented. I mean, many, many people contributed, but the inventor of this new language is Eliezer ben Yehuda, a very interesting fellow. Eliezer ben Yehuda was an Ashkenazi Russian Jew, but he loved Sephardic culture. He thought Sephardim were more the original Jews. And he comes up to Eretz Yisrael and he dresses like a Sephardi, and this is why, I mean, you know, when I was in elementary school, and I learned Hebrew with diktuk and everything else, but we learned Hebrew in the Ashkenazis pronunciation. There actually is an Ashkenazis spoken Hebrew. This language is extinct. Even in Mei Asharim, when they speak Hebrew, maybe they don't speak Hebrew that much, but when they speak Hebrew, they speak Ivrit. So the Ashkenazis language is dead. It is a dead language. It is used for davening. It is not used in conversation at all. You're never going to say Ani Ratzisi Lomar Lecha Sheyavo Leveisi LeShabbos. No, nobody talks that way. You talk Yiddish or you say Shabbat. I mean, even Meishar. But the truth of the matter is, there were at least those two major pronunciations for thousands of years. Okay? Eliezer ben Yehuda killed Ashkenazis Hebrew, so it no longer exists as a language. And Eliezer ben Yehuda was not religious, but not only was he not religious, he was also anti-religious in many, many ways. So many, many people, B'davka, don't want to embrace his innovation. And I'll give you some examples. Maybe it's minor, but you know, one example of kind of a disrespect of Kedusha is the word for electricity. Right? The word for electricity in Ivrit, as you know, I hope, is chashmal. Now, where does Eliezer ben Yehuda get the word chashmal for electricity? The answer is because in the book of Yechezkel, when it describes the Kisei HaKavod of Hashem, it talks about a radiant light around Hashem's throne of glory. He said, okay, so we'll use chashmal to describe, you know, this light. Chashmal is the light of the Shekhinah. How are you using it for an electric light bulb? Or, I can give you some indelicate references. There are references to fruits and vegetables that are frankly sexual in origin, actually, whatever it is, because the fruit resembles a certain shape and therefore it gets that word. You know, it's kind of a crazy thing. So people don't want to embrace that. That's a separate chashmal. I want to tell you one thing, though, an interesting mindset. Most of the Gedolim, most of the Rabbanim, most of the Charedim, most of the Shomer Shabbos, they didn't want to have anything to do with Eliezer ben Yehuda. The one exception was Rav Kook. Rav Kook, who of course embraced everybody. And Eliezer ben Yehuda used to go to Rav Kook because Eliezer ben Yehuda, when he wanted to invent new words, he would look at the Gemara, look at the Midrashim. He didn't care what the Gemara said, but he wanted to know the translation of the word. So he would go to Rav Kook. Rav Kook would explain to him what this word means, and then he would figure out how to adapt it in modern Hebrew. It's a very, he was a very creative person in that way. So one day he used to come to Rav Kook every Erev Shabbos, like for an hour, and Rav Kook would talk to him. Rav Kook was Makar of everybody, b'sei Rapanim Yafas. It's a big, big, big mila. So at the end of their conversation, Rav Kook said to him, "New Eliezer. Time to do tshuva. Isn't it time to do tshuva already?" And Eliezer ben Yehuda said to Rav Kook, he says, "Maybe the Rav is right." Anyway, that night, that Friday night, he died in bed. And the Levaya was right after Shabbos. And most religious people did not go to the funeral. But Rav Kook was maspidim. And Rav Kook said, he held that Eliezer ben Yehuda died mitaych tshuva, because the last day of his life, or the next to the last day, he said, maybe it's right. He says, we have to judge a person, l'kaf schus, that he died with hirhurei tshuva. And given the fact that we know that one of the merits of Am Yisrael in Mitzrayim is that they kept the Hebrew language. So there is a certain schus in someone who brings back, even though it's not totally Lashon HaKodesh, but he brings back Hebrew as a language. And that is a schus. You know, his house... I don't think it's marked. I don't know. His house is right at the entrance of Mea Sharim. It's an interesting place, right on Rehov Ethiopia, which comes into, I think, Yechezkel, whatever it is. It's right next to Mea Sharim, and that's why it occasionally gets defaced with graffiti. And I think that's why they took down the sign. But it's still, I think it's a, it is actually a little museum for the growth of the Hebrew language. Okay. Okay, have a good, one more. Yeah.
Said a bad word to someone on the telephone, and he asked him mechila afterwards on the phone also. Is he owes his obligation? And which one's more? Is he owes his obligation?
Yeah.
And should the person who asked mechila for it, should he think to himself, maybe he wasn't honest, maybe he still feels a way about the person?
I'm sorry, in other words, maybe the person who was mochel you was not honest?
No, maybe the person who was mochel the person wasn't honest. And since we're on a telephone,
I think that's a good nekuda. You're making a point that it's much more difficult when you're talking to somebody face to face. You can see if he means it, if he doesn't mean it. With a telephone, it's much more difficult.
And even the person asking the question,
right, or the other way around. Right. No, you're right. I was answering it with an intim salomer that everybody was sincere, but you're correct. If there are any sfeikas involved, it is better to do it face to face.
It's better to go to that person.
Absolutely, absolutely. Again, though, I will still bring in Rabbi Saul Solantra's psak. Don't ask mechila in an item that causes pain. But yeah, you are correct. Telephone is simply not as good. Email, I mean, these things are not as good because a lot of the way we understand a situation is by face to face. But if you do it by Skype would be okay. Because then you see panim el panim. Okay, have a good evening.